Unit 9. Text 1. A Red Light for Scuff Laws by Frank Trippett. Text. Law and order is the longest-running and probably the best-loved political issue in U.S. history. Yet it is painfully apparent that millions of Americans who would never think of themselves as lawbreakers, let alone criminals, are taking increasing liberties with the legal codes that are designed to protect and nourish their society. Indeed, there are moments today amid outlaw litter, tax cheating, illicit noise, and motorized anarchy when it seems as though the scuff law represents the wave of the future. Harvard sociologist David Riesman suspects that a majority of Americans have blithely taken to committing supposedly minor derelictions as a matter of course. Already, Riesman says, the ethic of U.S. society is in danger of becoming this. You're a fool if you obey the rules. Nothing could be more obvious than the evidence supporting Riesman. Scuff laws abound in amazing variety. The graffiti-prone turn public surfaces into visual rubbish. Bicyclists often ride as though two-wheeled vehicles are exempt from all traffic laws. Litter bugs convert their communities into trash dumps. Widespread flurries of ordinances have failed to clear public places of high-decibel portable radios, just as earlier laws failed to wipe out the beer-soaked hooliganism that plagues many parks. Tobacco addicts remain hopelessly blind to signs that say, "No smoking." Respectably dressed pot smokers no longer bother to duck out of public sight to pass around a joint. The flagrant use of cocaine is a festering scandal in middle and upper class life. And then there are, hello everybody, the jaywalkers. The dangers of scufflawry vary widely. The person who illegally spits on the sidewalk remains disgusting, but clearly poses less risk to others than the company that illegally buries hazardous chemical waste in an unauthorized location. The fare beater on the subway presents less threat to life than the landlord who ignores fire safety statutes. The most immediately and measurably dangerous scufflawry, however, also happens to be the most visible. The culprit is the American driver, whose lawless activities today add up to a colossal public nuisance. The hazards range from routine double parking that jams city streets to the drunk driving that kills some 25,000 people and injures at least 650,000 others yearly. Illegal speeding on open highways? New surveys show that on some interstate highways, 83% of all drivers are currently ignoring the federal 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. The most flagrant scofflaw of them all is the red light runner. The flouting of stop signals has got so bad in Boston that residents tell an anecdote about a cabbie who insists that red lights are just for decoration. The power of the stoplight to control traffic seems to be waning everywhere. In Los Angeles, red light running has become perhaps the city's most common traffic violation. In New York City, going through an intersection is like Russian roulette, admits Police Commissioner Robert J. McGuire. Today, it's a 50-50 toss-up as to whether people will stop for a red light. Meanwhile, his own police largely ignore the lawbreaking. Red light running has always been ranked as a minor wrong, and so it may be in individual instances. When the violation becomes habitual, widespread, and incessant, however, a great deal more than a traffic management problem is involved. The flouting of basic rules of the road leaves deep dents in the social mood. Innocent drivers and pedestrians pay a repetitious price in frustration, inconvenience, and outrage, not to mention a justified sense of mortal peril. The significance of red light running is magnified by its high visibility. If hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue, then furtiveness is the true outlaw's salute to the force of law and order. The red light runner, however, shows no respect whatever for the social rules, and society cannot help being harmed by any repetitions and brazen display of contempt for the fundamentals of order. The scofflaw spirit is pervasive. It is not really surprising when schools find, as some do, that children frequently enter not knowing some of the basic rules of living together. For all their differences, today's scofflaws are of a piece, as a symptom of elementary social demoralization, the loss by individuals of the capacity to govern their own behavior in the interest of others. The prospect of the collapse of public manners is not merely a matter of etiquette. Society's first concern will remain major crime, but a foretaste of the seriousness of incivility is suggested by what has been happening in Houston. Drivers on Houston freeways have been showing an increasing tendency to replace the rules of the road with violent outbreaks. Items from the Houston Police Department's new statistical category, Freeway Traffic Violence. 1. Driver flashes high beam lights at car that cut in front of him, whose occupants then hurl a beer can at his windshield, kick out his taillights, slug him 8 stitches worth. 2. Dump truck driver, annoyed by delay, batters trunk of stalled car ahead and its driver with steel bolt. 3. Hurrying driver of 18-wheel truck deliberately rear-ends car whose driver was trying to stay within 55-mile-per-hour limit. The Houston freeway syndrome has fortunately not spread everywhere. But the question is, will it? Americans are used to thinking that law and order is threatened mainly by stereotypical violent crime. When the foundations of U.S. law have actually been shaken, however, it has always been because ordinary law-abiding citizens took to skirting the law. Major instance. Prohibition, recalls Donald Barr Chidsey in On and Off the Wagon. Lawbreaker proved to be not painful, not even uncomfortable, but in a mild and perfectly safe way, exhilarating. People wiped out prohibition at last, not only because of the alcohol issue, but because scofflawry was seriously undermining the authority and legitimacy of government. Ironically, today's scofflaw spirit, whatever its undetermined origins, is being encouraged unwittingly by government at many levels. The failure of police to enforce certain laws is only the surface of the problem. They take their mandate from the officials and constituents they serve. Worse, most state legislatures have helped subvert popular compliance with the federal 55-mile-per-hour law, some of them by enacting puny fines that trivialize transgressions. On a higher level, the administration in Washington has dramatized its wish to nullify civil rights laws simply by opposing, instead of supporting, certain court-ordered desegregation rulings. With considerable justification, environmental groups, in the words of Wilderness Magazine, accuse the administration of destroying environmental laws by failing to enforce them or by enforcing them in ways that deliberately encourage noncompliance. Translation: scofflawry at the top. The most disquieting thing about the scofflaw spirit is its extreme infectiousness. Only a terminally foolish society would sit still and allow it to spread indefinitely. Text 2. Trust by Andy Rooney. Last night, I was driving from Harrisburg to Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, a distance of about 80 miles. It was late. I was late, and if anyone asked me how fast I was driving, I'd have to plead the Fifth Amendment to avoid self-incrimination. Several times I got stuck behind a slow-moving truck on a narrow road with a solid white line on my left, and I was clenching my fists with impatience. At one point along an open highway, I came to a crossroads with a traffic light. I was alone on the road by now, but as I approached the light, it turned red and braked to a halt. I looked left, right, and behind me. Nothing. Not a car, no suggestion of headlights. But there I sat, waiting for the light to change, the only human being for at least a mile in any direction. I started wondering why I refused to run the light. I was not afraid of being arrested because there was obviously no cop around, and there certainly would have been no danger in going through it. Much later that night, after I'd met with a group in Lewisburg and had climbed into bed near midnight, the question of why I'd stopped for that light came back to me. I think I stopped because it's part of a contract we all have with each other. It's not only the law, but it's an agreement we have, and we trust each other to honor it. We don't go through red lights. Like most of us, I'm more apt to be restrained from doing something bad by the social convention that disapproves of it than by any law against it. It's amazing that we ever trust each other to do the right thing, isn't it? And we do, too. Trust is our first inclination. We have to make a deliberate decision to mistrust someone or to be suspicious or skeptical. Those attitudes don't come naturally to us. It's a damn good thing, too, because the whole structure of our society depends on mutual trust, not distrust. This whole thing we have going for us would fall apart if we didn't trust each other most of the time. In Italy, they have an awful time getting any money for the government because many people just plain don't pay their income tax. Here, the Internal Revenue Service makes some gestures toward enforcing the law, but mostly they just have to trust that we'll pay what we owe. There has often been talk of a tax revolt in this country, most recently among unemployed auto workers in Michigan, and our government pretty much admits if there was a widespread tax revolt here, they wouldn't be able to do anything about it. We do what we say we'll do. We show up when we say we'll show up, we deliver when we say we'll deliver, and we pay when we say we'll pay. We trust each other in these matters, and when we don't do what we've promised, it's a deviation from the normal. It happens often that we don't act in good faith and in a trustworthy manner, but we still consider it unusual and we're disappointed with the person or organization that violates the trust we have in them. I am looking for something good to say about mankind today. I hate to see a story about a bank swindler who has jiggered the books to his own advantage because I trust banks. I don't like them, but I trust them. I don't go in and demand that they show me my money all the time just to make sure they still have it. It's the same buying a can of coffee or a quart of milk. You don't take the coffee home and weigh it to make sure it's a pound. There isn't time in life to distrust every person you meet or every company you do business with. I hate the company that started selling beer in 12-ounce bottles years ago. One of the million things we take on trust is that a beer bottle contains 12 ounces. It's interesting to look around and at people and compare their faith or lack of faith in other people with their success or lack of successes in life. The patsies, the suckers, the people who always assume everyone else is as honest as they are, make out better in the long run than the people who distrust everyone And they're a lot happier, even if they get taken once in a while. I was so proud of myself for stopping for that red light, and inasmuch as no one would ever have known what a good person I was on the road from Harrisburg to Lewisburg, I had to tell someone. Listening in and speaking out. Nothing Real is Impossible by Gerald Jemplosky. When she first came to me, Colleen was legally blind. The term applies to those whose sight is so limited that they cannot function as sighted, although they might have a small amount of close vision. From birth, she had had a condition known as retrolental fibroplasias, which is a progressive accumulation of scar tissue behind the retina, which may eventually cause blindness or at least severely limited vision. She was born and raised in the Los Angeles area by parents who saw value in her attending regular public school instead of special schools for the handicapped. They reasoned that this would better prepare her for the real world. It was obviously a good decision for Colleen, although there is, of course, no right or wrong procedure that can be applied to all cases involving handicapped children. With the understanding assistance of teachers who always seated her in the front of the room and gave her additional auditory and visual cues, she graduated from elementary and high school and then decided on a small college away from home. Several years ago, Colleen became aware that many people were discussing supplements to traditional medical procedures, and she began to hear evidence that the mind can affect the body. It was shortly after this that she began to visit me. I introduced her to the book A Course in Miracles. We talked about the very important concept from A Course in Miracles. There is no order of difficulty in miracles. Miracles can be defined as changes in perception which remove the blocks to our awareness of love's presence. Therefore, they can be seen as a natural occurrence. Although miracles are not physical phenomena, changes at the physical level may sometimes accompany them. I shared with Colleen my conviction that anyone can learn to shift his perception and see the presence of love, and that is true sight. One day, Colleen asked a question that was very important to her. Is it possible for me to regain my sight? I replied, anything is possible. You do not have to be a negative example of people with retrolental fibroplasias. She began to grasp the idea that the thoughts we put into our minds determine our perceptions. She began to work on positive mental pictures, thereafter practicing peace of mind, peace of God, became her single goal, practicing forgiveness her single function, and listening to and being directed by her inner voice became her way of experiencing a sense of complement and oneness. She began to forgive God and the universe for her blindness. Her bitterness dissolved and was replaced by an increasing sense of peace. As this happened, her head and neck pains began to ease. Gradually, a subtle but quite real change began to take place in the way Colleen pictured herself. She told me later, it was as though my attitude about myself began to shift. Where I had always treated myself as a blind person, I now began to think of myself as normal. Even so, Colleen was totally unprepared for the partial recovery that happened in March 1978. Her daytime vision improved enough so that she could see where she was going, and her ophthalmologist informed her that she was now legally sighted during the daytime, although she remained legally blind at night. Colleen continued in school to prepare herself to be of service to others who are ill. She is primarily interested in the holistic health approach in which one attempts to assist the whole person rather than to treat only sick organs. She has helped many people at our center and in other cities and has been active in our telephone network, working with blind people on the phone throughout the United States.